thanks for having me on. You know, it's it's been a long time, and I know you guys don't usually do this with guys that play in the game, but you know, it's an honor to be out here.
What did you think?
I'm still talking.
What did you think of the game?
No, I'm still talking. Yeah, it's great
say
to have
something.
Me. Oh yeah, I am. It's, you know, it's can you put the camera more me in the center? All right, thanks. No, it's like I said, I think you should have guys on here more often. You know, I think they can add a little more color to the conversation. Is that what you say, the color commentator? It can add a little more color. Are you awkward? You feel awkward here in the middle?
No, not at all.
Oh, just move this in a little closer. Thanks. It's like I said, I'm happy to be on here. It was a good game we played today and yesterday, and you know, I'm happy. I don't know what you guys usually talk about out here. So.
All right.
Floor is yours, my man. Floor is yours.
I was kidding around.
I know,
in the interview. But wait a second. Give me one more second. Yeah, bring the camera back over.
I'm over here. Bob McGill, quiet. Quiet. That's from Leafs TV way back?
Yeah, I'm trying to... I don't even remember when that was.
Well, you would have still been playing, right?
Well, I was from the Marlies. Yeah, Marlies 2010 to 2013. And the Big Daddy was, I'm trying to remember. I didn't do many interviews.
Is that because you got asked or didn't get asked? Or is that because, no, I'm not interested. You media folks, you can stay over there.
No, we used to have fun with it. I don't know why I didn't, why didn't they talk to me more often?
Yeah, you should be, call them out. You've got the platform now.
Can you put the camera more me in the center?
Oh, God. Ryan Mon has found a drop.
See, you can't have any fun, eh? Yeah. The media just picks you apart.
Ryan Mon has found a drop. I bet you that one is going to find its way onto this show often.
And that was John Bartlett, too?
John Bartlett and
Big Daddy
Big
McGill.
Daddy Bob McGill. Number of years ago. I don't know where the guys dug that up.
I'd never heard that.
Quite,
yeah, I'm still not sure where that's from, but Bartz is now doing Sportsnet.
Yeah, he's
play-by-play.
Doing
so
Leafs games. And
yeah. Well, he does across
made
the
a
league.
Stop in Montreal and all that. Oh, you know, he's doing great. And Bob McGill is...
He's still there, yeah. Well, I still do the games. He does the color.
Yeah, and you see him in the press box at Leafs games, too.
Yeah, he's there as well. He does the pre-show. I believe still for the Leafs, so he's busy. He's great on there too. So I always go before the Marlies game start, and we kind of go through, and I see his huge spread with all the names on it. So
he's got the line charts.
Yeah,
line
charts, which is great. I love when they're in. You know, each guy has their own system, right?
Yep.
He's got the names in large font across the board.
Well, because you got to be able.
Oh, sorry.
Look.
I'm talking. Still talking.
You got to be able to look down, and Mon, you got to cut in with that all the time. Ziggy ends a sentence.
I just got that's from 2012, Marlies.
Where'd you find it?
I just got the text.
Oh, really? You got friends who are awake listening to
yes,
the show this early?
So many friends.
We have to make sure that we're up and at it right at 6 o'clock and
make sure we know what we're talking about.
All right.
And when clips are from. Yes. The good old Marley days.
All right. Well, that's 8 years ago then. And you were already getting set to be a media diva.
Yeah.
almost a decade ago. Wendell Clark's going to join us at the top of the 8 o'clock hour. So we can't wait to talk to him. And
see what he's up to.
Well, he might not be up yet.
We'll see what he's up to.
Oh, yes. Well, we'll see what he's up to. I would imagine if Wendell comes on the program, I don't think Wendell Clark is capable of a heel turn in Toronto, but if he's like, oh, yeah, I'm organizing big gatherings all over the city, yeah, big alum events, this, that, and the other thing, that could get him into some trouble. I would hope that Wendell is at home, chilling out, just like the rest of us.
I think
he owns the city.
I think he does have he has the key, but... I just pictured a time like this, Wendell be on some farm somewhere just saying, oh, yeah, I got a farm up an hour north of the city. I'm just hanging out here, just relaxing, you know, That's what I kind of see.
It's
Wendell
such a
doing.
Weird time. I mean, this is the thing where it doesn't matter if you're a famous current or former athlete. Doesn't matter if you're an actor, a musician. I mean, there was tragedy in the music world. Adam Schlesinger of Fountains of Wayne. Stacey's mom.
Really?
Passed away of coronavirus yesterday. She's 52 years old.
Wow.
So it doesn't discriminate. Doesn't. We've all got to behave in the same way. It's kind of an equalizer in a sad way these days. It's an equalizer that if we are behaving differently, if we are taking this for granted, this virus is not going to spread is not going to stop.
No, and Bill Gates was talking a couple weeks ago, and he does mention that. He says it doesn't matter who you are. This is something that has affected everyone, and to listen to the health professionals right now and don't be gathering. I feel like people are still posting stuff online about gatherings at Tim Hortons and all these places. It's still, I feel like some are, taking it seriously and some aren't.
Yeah, there are ways to do it. There are ways to do it that keeps your distance from the people you're seeing and never brings you into contact with them and should be safe, considered the guidelines. I mean, I shared the story of how I'm going out to Oakville every weekend to see my folks. We meet in their driveway when I pull in and we go for a walk.
Ah, that's nice.
And we keep our distance. And anybody who's coming at us on the sidewalk, one of the groups moves out onto the road. The streets aren't busy. These are small community streets in Oakville. We're not talking about Jarvis during rush hour. So there's ways to stay apart from people. And as the weather gets better, one of the things I plan to do is show up at my folks' place on a weekend, open the side gate, and just walk around to the backyard and sit, and they'll come out and join me there, and we'll stay 6 feet apart or 8 feet apart or whatever it is. There are ways to do it. And then I don't get into the house and touch things, and if I'm a carrier and I don't even know it, I'm not putting anybody at risk. Mm-hmm. There's ways around it. So we'll get in touch with Wendell Clark a couple of hours from now. Gord Stellick will be along in just a few minutes, hopefully with some really good Harold Ballard stories. We've been teasing this for a while, and Andrew Peters was on the program yesterday morning, buddy of yours, a former Buffalo Sabre, and you go way back with him because you were first drafted by the Sabres.
A year after him.
But you were then later drafted a couple of years after that by the Carolina Hurricanes, and that's where you started your pro hockey career because something happened in Buffalo that actually made...
I just wanted to go to another draft. I had so much fun at the first draft.
Yeah, why get...
In Boston, I was like, you know what? This one's in Florida. Let's go down there.
Okay, well, and why get the professional career started and start making money when you can just mess around for a couple of years and get picked up by another team?
I actually got drafted. Remember during one of the lockouts, they tried to push another league? I forget what they're going to call it. They were trying to put another league on. I was drafted actually a third time.
Oh, my God.
Forget. Do you remember the name of the...
I don't remember this at all.
There was an actual draft during the 04 lockout. So I did get drafted, and they were trying to start another league up, which obviously didn't go through. But
so what's the story with Buffalo? You were drafted by the Sabres in 1999.
Okay. So you have 2 years to sign.
Yes.
Okay. So I go back for two more years of junior, which is what everyone does. Well, most guys do that. Some obviously sign early as an 18 or 19-year-old, and they go to the NHL. So it comes down right to the last day. We don't stop. They don't start negotiating until 4 or 5 days before serious negotiation, before the deadline, and going back and forth, finally decide on a number. They send in their copy to the league. We send in ours. The problem is that they sent in a different copy than what we had. So the numbers were different. That's a problem.
Did the numbers favor you on their contract or on your contract? I would have to say it'd be on your contract.
Ours had the right one.
Yes.
They sent in the old one, but it was so close to the line that mine is in with the facts time on it. I got the contract in, and Buffalo even called in saying, okay, we're having trouble trying to get the contract because usually there's a number of deadline deals, right? So sometimes it's hard to get those faxes in right at the last minute. So what the Sabres do is they call the league and saying they have the right numbers. It's signed by us. That's the one. Don't do ours. There was a big issue. League would not let it in. There was an issue with that. That didn't count. You can't call in interviews. This is why we'll talk to Gord about what they used to do.
Yeah.
They have fax machines back
in the
80s.
Well, we'll find Gord will be on in just a second and we'll ask him how contracts got.
Yeah.
So, sorry. So just to be clear, the Sabres tried to get the deal, the contract that they originally faxed with the lower number be the one the league verified.
No, there was, yes, but by accident.
Okay.
So, but they called in and said, no. Him, Zygmunis and his agent, they have the right contract. That's the one we're going by.
I see. Okay.
That all got done by the deadline. League said, well, we got to review this. I believe that was on a Friday. They reviewed it through the weekend. And then going into Monday, they said, okay, fine. We're going to let that one in and two others that were in question. Kyle Wanvig and I want to say like Rob Zepp or I can't think. There was three of us.
Sure.
So league says, you know what? We're going to let them all in, which they usually do. They have these problems sometimes at the deadline for entry-level contracts. So then it has to go to the Players Association. They have to approve it. Now, the league says, yes, they can go in. And apparently the Players Association said, no, we're not letting them in. So now we're sitting there and saying, what do you mean? Our union I'm about to enter is now saying our contracts are no good. They wanted some rules changed in the CBA, calling in contracts. There was a number of things, right? They wanted a couple things changed deep in the CBA. The league says, no, we'll deal with that next round of negotiations. Next CBA. Yeah. So the Player Association just said, no, we're not letting them in. That's what happened.
So your own union.
Yeah, that's the story.
Blocked you.
I got blocked.
You got blocked by your own people from entering the league.
But who knows how much deeper there is in all these stories, right?
Like, well, there's always way more.
Yeah, you really don't know. You think you know the whole thing, but the whole side of the story, but there might have been some deeper stuff.
All right,
it might have been the league just being like, you know what, we're tired of. But that's apparently the story that I was told about what happened.
Okay, and so then you went back to Kingston and you played.
No, so I re-entered the draft a couple weeks later.
Okay.
Drafted by Carolina Hurricanes.
The following.
Yep. No, that same year.
So okay.
It's 2 years, right? I got drafted in 99 and 01.
Yes.
So I have to sign by June 1st and then the draft's at the end of June. So I go back into the draft 3 weeks later.
That's right.
Drafted. Okay. But now I'm eligible to play in the minors. So that's when teams sign players. Is when they're 19, 20, right? And they can 20 turning 21 for majority guys. And you can sign and then you go to camp and make either team and go from there. But they still get asked by, when I cross the border into Buffalo, they still ask me about the fax machine.
I bet.
It's still like, a lot of them are just diehard Sabres fans.
Well, I don't know if it was, and Gord Stellick's with us, so we'll bring him on here in a second. I don't know if it was the hockey news, but there was some publication recently that did the top 50 moments. Some of them were blunders in Buffalo Sabres history, and your situation with the fax machine came in at 21. So it's in the minds of Sabres fans, and it's a part of that franchise's history.
Yeah, Jim Benning was the guy that drafted me. He was the head scout.
Okay.
Head of scouting.
Yeah. Now the GM in Vancouver.
All right. And I've talked to him a couple of times. It's just like, doesn't budge on talking about the situation or anything.
Yeah.
Well, just like, well, didn't go through. Because I talked to him on Hockey Central.
He's not feeling emotional about it 20 years later. Gord Stellick is
still talking.
Mon is going to cut me off. Mon is going to cut me off all morning with that drop.
Just cancel out some of the noise in the back, I think we could get you.
Yeah, no question. No question. If you can isolate the voice, I'm going to be screwed. Michael? Going to be like David Branch. Michael? Oh, you're still there? Okay. Gord Stellick is the host of Leafs Nation pre and post game here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and he's with us. He's been listening to the whole Mike Zigomanis story. Gord, do you have any horror stories of last minute contracts being sent into the league? And I don't know how that would have played out back when you were GM of the Leafs. If those were phone calls, were there fax machines then in the late 80s? How did that all play out?
Well, good morning, guys. And to answer your question, now, also keep in mind, there wasn't the threat of guys becoming free agent, which just changed the dynamic quite a bit. It wasn't like you got it. There weren't these kind of deadlines because you weren't basically a free agent until 33 or something like that. So, but to answer your question, you know, the old telex machines, we called them Twix machines, but you know, the old like telex that they'd be in the newspaper, in the newsrooms and radio stations, like, you know, you type it out and it would have a hard copy, and then you'd phone it up and you'd connect to the telex number for NHL Central Registry in Montreal. And so that's how you would do trades as well. So you would copy, say, the Philadelphia Flyers, and they'd send a reciprocal Twix back confirming I've traded Mike Zigomanis for Scott MacArthur, and you'd copy NHL Central Registry, and then it would be confirmed. It'd be done in a matter of like a minute, where nowadays there's a big production when you make a trade. But the contract, you would just advise them and the papers would follow, because there weren't so many looming free agent things. The one thing you had to do, though, was you had to tender a contract properly, and you would send that by registered mail. That would go by registered mail in the summer, that if a guy's contract was up, you know, much like the Red Sox fell down years ago with Carlton Fisk. And I'll tell you what as well, there were screw-ups in the New Jersey Devils. At one point, I think it was Brian Rafalski and John Madden. Years ago, it wasn't tendered properly. And Nashville a couple of summers ago, same thing. And basically, they were kind of kept quiet. And those were really competent guys. I mean, Lou Lamoriello running Jersey, David Poile running Nashville. And it gave those guys a little bit more leverage, because technically they could become unrestricted free agents because it wasn't tendered properly.
Were you giving free rein kind of in Toronto with Harold Ballard kind of breathing down your neck every single day?
Well, it was you had more flexibility than people thought. But, you know, I look at it now that, you know, I was 30 and he was 86. And as I got older, and my dad passed at 92 a couple of years ago, but I started to understand more what 86 was, right? And one was about his sense of money was like 40 years earlier. So that part was a struggle, but you could also use that with the agents knew it, right? You just pointed to Ballard lived in Maple Leaf Gardens. So literally you could point to his office that, you know, we got to make a profit here, and he watches the pennies and that kind of stuff. So yeah, we were not a free spending organization back then.
Gord Stellick is our guest, and he is the host of Leafs Nation pre and post here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. We've had a bunch of former Leafs on in the last few weeks. We had a lot of fun with Gary Lehman about a week ago as the 30th anniversary, Gord, of his 50th goal being scored in his 50-goal season came upon us. And he was telling some fun stories. Wendell Clark's going to be our guest here in a couple of hours. I'm interested, and part of the reason I ask you this question is it your age as general manager of the Leafs in the late 80s is not that far off from the age that Kyle Dubas is now. Did the fact that you were, from an age perspective, a peer of Maple Leafs players, did that in any way, do you think, change your relationship with the players? The fact that you were kind of at the same phase of your life as a lot of the guys on the ice?
Well, you know, and it's funny, Brendan Shanahan kids that, yeah, it's one record Kyle knows he still doesn't have, right? That he's the second youngest general manager there. And Scott, one thing that was different in my situation, say, compared to Kyle was, like, I'd been there for 10 years. It was a small office, and I knew the administrative work through and through. I was the travel guy, so I knew all the guys, right? When I got hired, I just went back to my office and, you know, started working, right? And so I think the big thing always is to be yourself, whatever yourself is. Like don't think you have to all of a sudden, you know, be someone else. Like, you know, because, hey, I viewed it as a strength. I mean, I'm young, but Harold Ballard is 86. John Brophy, who is the coach I'm inheriting, is an older guy, you know, and on that way. So I actually enjoyed knowing the players. Never make the mistake that you, when I say the, that they're your friends. I just mean it's still a business thing. They can be your friends. But, you know, when you're – I know there was one guy that was an assistant trainer 1 year, and he just became too buddy-buddy, and that was it for him, right? So in my case, I actually like being able to have guys pop up to my office and just shoot the breeze from time to time.
How often would you go to the coaching staff about certain guys that you were looking at to maybe sign or trade, or did you go for any advice to back then? Because you hear about the relationships between Dubas and Babcock, Dubas and Keefe, and how, you know, a lot of times they'll go to guys, and, you know, Mike Babcock was known as to be have strong opinions on certain players and send messages to Dubas and management depending on sitting guys or maybe not playing them as much as they want.
It's funny, Serge Savard said to me, don't listen to your coach about trades, because they fall in love with certain players. They've got a different agenda. And you know, so, but Mike, you had to, I think, engage everybody in the conversation about it, and certainly, you know, kept them, you know, I don't know, you kept them abreast about things. I don't, some guys keep it close to the vest, but I welcomed their input and, you know, try to have them on side about certain things and what have you. But if you, at the end of the day, you know, you've got to be the one accountable for that trade. And I made actually quite a few trades. I mean, they weren't all biggies, but you know, the one that lives with me is one I did for the coach, you know, about getting some toughness and adding John Kordick. And this isn't like a regret or whatever. I mean, we did need some toughness in that, but it was obviously, if I had a do over, I would have done that one over.
I don't, it's 30 years on or 30 plus years on, Gordon. And that is a trade, as you say, that people remember. Can you take us through the conversations you were having with John Brophy or maybe with others? I think people would be fascinated to know how something like that ends up coming to be.
Okay. And keep in mind, this is a very, very unique time. Okay.
Of course.
So, I become general manager, and I wasn't expecting to be general manager. I just had basically, we had no general manager. Harold, Mr. Ballard had fired Jerry McNamara during the season, and we'd kind of run it. And he asked me for some opinions, and I gave him an 18-page synopsis of stuff. I kind of went at him about things. You know, I figured it's now or never. And then I found out I was general manager that Milt Dunnell had the headline in the Toronto Star, and that was Ballard's buddy, right? So that's how I find out. So now I know I've got John Brophy as my coach. I'm inheriting him. And we're at the draft table, actually, and Brof wanted to get rid of Bory Asami. And it got a little weird at the draft table. And I saw Ballard kind of, you know, turn on Brof a little bit. And then Brof called me and said, okay, you know what? You're going to have no problems with me. No problem. Like, he realized he'd kind of go. So the season gets going. And, I mean, we got Eddie Olchuk, Gary Lehman, Vinny Domfus, Daniel Marois. You know, guys like that. We got a lot of skilled guys, and you know, Brof values toughness. That's part of what it is. So, I mean, I'm trying to remember. We added, like, you know, Brian Curran. We drafted Ty Domi, which actually turned out later to be a real good pick. And the season started, and we started off well. And Brof and Russ Cordinal is a guy I loved. I was there when he got drafted as an 18-year-old. He's one of those guys I was talking about that actually I was a friend of and remain great friends of. And Brof, you know, like, Brof found him a little bit mouthy. He wasn't physical, all that stuff. You know, like, Brof loved Al Secord, who'd been added in a trade a year earlier from Chicago. So the season starts, and basically, you know, he's playing Danny Daou ahead of Russ. I think whatever, it was 12 games, and I think Russ was a healthy scratch for three or four. He was a fourth-line guy, and we were in the Chicago Stadium once, and get ready to play, and all of a sudden Russ found out he's not dressed. And I was pissed because I didn't know that either. I thought Russ was going to play because we talked about that. And he just said, I got to get out of here, blah, blah, blah. And I kind of sighed, and I kind of said, you know what, you know, just, you know, keep quiet, mind your P's and Q's, and I'll figure something out. You're right. You don't deserve to be treated like this. And so that's in the back of my mind, because that situation is not going to be tenable with the guy as a coach. And then the tough guy who Brof knew from his time in the Montreal organization. And I'm not going to, you know, if you go back, there's a lot of positives to John Kordick. When I was, I used to do the Hall of Fame induction weekend, and I would do, you know, interview the players. And I had this half hour chat with Cam Neely, about being a teammate of John Kordick's in Portland and how he was, you know, an all-star junior defenseman back then. Anyway, the point being is he's available and Russ is a guy I promised to move somewhere. And he's got no future as long as John Brophy's the coach. So, you know, I always look at it that I made one move to help Roth, and ultimately a couple of months later, because also what had happened too, we played the Bruins and then we played Marty McSorley and the LA Kings, and they'd been real physical. Like they'd run at Boya Somming, and a lot of what Brophy talked about would maybe overemphasize what was sort of shown in those couple of games. So anyway, the trade happened, and that's where back and forth with Serge Savard a little bit. He was kind of a man of mystery. He was hard to pin down. He would leave me messages. It'd be weird. You push your thing at home and it's Serge, but he never would leave a number. So you had to kind of track him down on a daily basis.
Gord, that was fantastic. We really appreciate you peeling the curtain back. I think, especially in this time with no sports, this gives us an opportunity to take people behind the scenes. Gary Lehman did it so well for us last week, and we've enjoyed these types of conversations we've been able to have. So I appreciate you shedding some light on that, and let's do this again soon. We always enjoy it.
Yeah, and the quick last one, Russ adds to it. We were practicing at North York Centennial Arena that day, which is Herb Carnegie Arena now.
Okay.
And he gets a note from Curly Davies to call the Leaf office. So he goes into Curly's office with the old rotary phone, and that's what he phones back. And wow, he finds out, you know, the trade. So, I mean, it was a very different animal back then. And I enjoyed the chat, too. Ziggy, I didn't know that one because Kyle Wanvig was the big story. You know, there were the trio of those fax machine jam-ups. So I'm glad everything worked out for you.
Thanks a lot, Gord. Yeah, Wanvig and Zepp, I believe. We'll look it
up. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
We'll do a little digging on
that.
Gord, we'll call on you again. Thanks, very soon. Really appreciate it, as always.
See you guys. Stay safe.
Gord Stellick is the host of Leafs Nation Pre and Post here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. The former general manager of the Maple Leafs from way back in the late 80s. And that, Courtnell for Kordick lives in infamy in this city. And as he said, look, that's the trade that I wear. But I think peeling the curtain back, that's a clip we got to throw up on Twitter and on our social media platforms later today. A great, great insight from Gord Stellick. Hugh Burrell is in studio. We'll Burrell the lead next. Mr. Burrell. What's up?
That's my name. Don't wear it out.
Well, I wonder if we're going to have any huge-ass bike race trivia questions at any point over the course of the morning.
I think we have exhausted our supply of those.
I think Mike Gentile yesterday gave you that question in the all-or-nothing game just because the name Hugh was in it.
Love it.
You know?
Love it.
This is where we're at, pal. We're almost 3 weeks into this sportsless run.
It seems longer.
It feels like 3 years,
yeah.
Doesn't it?
Yeah. But we're having fun.
Oh, yeah, of course.
We are here for you, the listener.
Making it up as we go, baby. So what do you got for us today?
Stopped us before, Scotty.
You bet.
All right, with the NHL season in limbo right now, no one could blame you for looking ahead to next year. We are. Some players are. Like the Leafs' Jason Spezza, who is an unrestricted free agent next season on Hockey Central yesterday. Spezza was asked if there have been any contract talks with the Leafs.
No, we haven't. And you know, during the season, I didn't think there was any need to. It's you played as I wanted to show value as a player. I do want to play again next year. I feel like I can really help this team out. I'm not in this to make money. I'm here to just play, and I want to be a part of the Leafs. And like I said, I want to grow this to the point where we can win, and I want to be a part of it. So I hope they feel the same way, and I'd love to be back here again next year, but we'll just kind of wait and see. We're in a time right now where that stuff doesn't matter. We just got to solve what's being solved, and that stuff takes care of itself. But I'm motivated. And
so what did you guys think when Jason Spezza signed with the Leafs, and what did you think so far of his play?
When they brought him in, it was almost like they don't get Patrick Marleau back, and they needed that kind of veteran presence in the room. When they added him, I wasn't I don't know. It wasn't like I was thrilled about it, and it wasn't the worst deal. You get him on a minimum, you bring him in for the year. They're not tied up long term, some big contract like Marler where it cost them a first round draft pick to get out of it. Try him out, see how it works out. Coaching staff, players, is there a fit there? Is there some chemistry in the room?
And now?
And it looks like he did bring that this year. You got to remember, you get scratched in your home opener against your former team. Like, that was probably the worst thing that's happened in his career. I mean, we were scratching our heads when that happened. I still can't believe they did that to him. So for him to rebound from that, and he's been in and out of the lineup, and he just seems to always put up points, can play him on any line, and he does bring that leadership in the room that this Leafs team needs.
I think there's no better example of the sign of the times, because Jason Spezza is a 1983 baby. So whenever it is that his birthday comes this year, he turns 37. Like, there's mileage left there ordinarily, right? For a guy of that caliber. He's not the player he used to be. We all accept that. And here is a 36 going on 37-year-old, presuming he hasn't had his birthday yet, on Hockey Central at noon saying, I'm not here to negotiate. I will take the league minimum, and I want to play for this team, the Toronto Maple Leafs. Or I want to play in the National Hockey League next year. Hands up, volunteer. I won't negotiate a cent over the league minimum. I just want to keep playing. I still have something to give. That would have been unheard of 20 years ago, that a guy of Jason Spezza's caliber would effectively be on a radio show in the middle of a weird pandemic saying, hey, somebody give me another chance. I'm not done yet. Just wouldn't be heard of. Yeah. It's crazy what, and again, the salary cap and the way that teams construct their rosters has everything to do with it. But it's just crazy that Jason Spezza's like, hey, I'll play. I'm here.
Yep.
Sign me.
It's a great attitude. And if there is a silver lining in all this, that mileage doesn't go on the tires if the season is canceled. So he saves that on his body for sure. So, you know, that's something. Also in Hockey Central yesterday, Hall of Famer defenseman Chris Pronger won a cup with the Ducks and the Hart and Norris trophies with the Blues. He was asked the difference between young players now to when he played.
You know, kids nowadays, they're a little bit different. Obviously, they've grown up with the internet. They've grown up, with everybody knowing who they are and the notoriety and these high-level AAA hockey teams going to all these different places. Some of these teams fly on private jets. I mean, it gets a little crazy. But I think they didn't play in that era where toughness and grinding through adversity and things like that, they've never really had that. And I think the NHL, a lot of times, is the first place they get that, where the games can be hard. They're challenged, especially when their young players come into the league. They're challenged physically. They're challenged mentally. They're challenged by their coach. They're challenged by their teammates for the most part. And
so this isn't just some old media guy ripping on young kids these days. This is a Hall of Famer who's not really ripping on them, but he's saying that there is a difference now. These kids are more or less coddled, and sometimes the first time they face any kind of adversity, any kind of situation where things don't go their way, is in the NHL, and it's interesting to see how they react to that.
Yeah, guys have grown up. Remember, you're a star in minor hockey, then you go to junior and you put up 100 plus points a year, you're given everything, and then all of a sudden you're 19 20 18, and things aren't that easy as they were before, and you don't really know how to deal with it. And that's,
you're playing against men now.
That's very difficult. So you're going to a tougher game, an older game. Maybe coaches they're from a previous era where it's not always, they don't make things easy on you when things don't go well. So you have all those different factors. It's can be a lot for young guys to play with. And it's almost like you lose a little bit of confidence when you get to that pro level, and you've never had that lack of confidence when you're playing. And it's very difficult sometimes to find or get back when you lose it.
I think Vladimir Guerrero Jr. found that out in the big leagues with the Blue Jays last year. I want to take a different tact on this. I always have two questions, or maybe a question and a statement, when somebody says kids these days. Who raised them?
Yeah.
Who raised those kids? Often the people saying kids these days are the ones who raised the kids. So if they're spoiled, that's a reflection of those who raise them.
Yep.
Right? And they are a product of their environment.
Yeah.
They are a product of their environment. You can't. We once were the kids that the older generation was saying kids these days about.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
now
we were once them. Yeah.
We are now the generation saying kids these days.
We weren't as bad.
Oh, every generation never thinks it's as bad, but this generation is the worst, by the way. The NBA is in the same boat as the NHL right now. So much uncertainty as to when or if the season will resume. The NBA was the first major North American sports league to postpone play after Jazz center Rudy Gobert tested positive. Raptors president Masai Ujiri was on Tim and Sid last night, and he gave credit to NBA commissioner Adam Silver for taking swift action.
We had gone for an NBA Africa board meeting, and it was about five or six of us in the room, and he told us where this was going, you know, like, and what he was hearing. And I looked at it, and I was like, okay, is he, like, overreacting, or is he, you know, and he was right.
So the NBA, it's a leader in so many areas, and it certainly has been the leader in terms of a league dealing with this pandemic.
I think that's a fair-ish comment to make. If Rudy Gobert doesn't test positive on that night that he does, that game doesn't get canceled. And what happened that night was the Jazz game, I want to say it was in Oklahoma City.
Yes, it was.
They walk off the court after the positive test is revealed. Word trickles all the way to Sacramento, where one of the referees who was officiating that game between the Kings and the New Orleans Pelicans had officiated the Raptors Jazz game two nights before. Okay, this person is in close contact with Rudy Gobert potentially. We can't play this game here. So it was the positive test that put the NBA at the forefront. They were going to try to push through for as long as they could playing games. So I'm hesitant to just give them complete and total credit.
Yeah, but at least they did have the foresight to not play that game and to actually once the horses are out of the barn, they were kind of the first to
players would be saying, I don't want anything to do with this.
All right. And no doubt you've been spending a lot of time binge watching Netflix over the past couple of weeks, and no doubt you've stumbled across a little show called Tiger King. Yeah. Tells the story of a group of eccentric big cat owners in the United States. There's conflict. Oh, there's intrigue. Oh, yeah, and one of the characters named Carol Baskin may have fed her ex-husband to the tigers. So, it happens sometimes. So who better to comment on one suspected murderer than another suspected murderer? Here now with his take is O.J. Simpson.
One thing I will say, there's not a shred of doubt in my mind that lady's husband is Tiger Tsushima right now. I'm just saying.
I know you're going to be shocked by this, but OJ made those comments coming off a golf course where I presume he was looking for the killer of his ex-wife.
Yeah. The irony of Tiger King is that the animals have the ability to tear all of those people limb from limb, and they don't do it. And yet they're the ones considered to be wild and out of control.
This, I'm three up. You guys are
the fact that any of those idiots.
Yeah.
And we have a perfect combination, an imperfect combination, an imperfectly perfect combination of bad human beings who are also stupid.
It's a perfect storm.
And, I mean, we see what happens when some of those rise to the highest offices in the world. But that's what we're dealing with. And the Tigers, you know, the Tigers were so forgiving of these people is my one takeaway.
Well, they fed them. That's why. I'm three episodes deep into this, and I can't take my eyes off of it.
Well, it's porn.
It's
porn. That's what it is, though, Hugh. It's porn.
Yeah, I mean, you and OJ. What did he say the sixth episode too in his Twitter thing?
I don't.
He goes like, this is the most ridiculous show. You know, I'm. And then he says, I'm only six episodes in. Isn't it only seven episodes?
It's only seven episodes.
But he's talking about it like, man, it is just so bad. He goes, I'm six episodes in. It's like, well, you're almost finished it. So it couldn't have been that bad. But OJ, did he not have the surgical gloves on? I think he had the latex on.
Do they fit?
If they don't fit,
you must acquit.
You must acquit. I don't know if it's Gore-Tex. Mr. Costanza. Don't know if it's Gore-Tex. Shai Davidi will be along after the top of the 7 o'clock hour. Wendell Clark at 8 o'clock, and the phone lines are open right now, 416-870-0590, 416-870-0590. We have $100 in Untuckit gift cards to give away. If you want to be the contestant to play All or Nothing, get to dialing. We do it next. All right, this is our new game, and we call it All or Nothing. It's pretty self-explanatory. You need to be either really good or really bad to win it all. Three true or false questions, and how you answer the first question will determine what you need to do with the next two. So if you get the first question correct, you got to get the next two questions correct to win. If you get the first question incorrect, don't worry. We're not hanging up on you. It just means you've got to get the next two questions correct. Intentionally incorrect. So be perfectly perfect or perfectly imperfect. Three true or false questions, $100 in Untuckit gift cards up for grabs. And Mary is this morning's contender. Mary, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. All right, here we go. Here we go with the first one. The Leafs are in pursuit of a free agent from the KHL. The name of this skilled winger is Pavel Barber. True or false?
True.
Ah, it's false. It's actually Alexander Barabanov.
Alexander Barabanov.
Yeah. Pavel Barber is the guy with the stick handling videos.
Okay, so Mary, there's no problem here. First question does not ruin your opportunity, but what you need to do now is play the counterintuitive game. You have to get the next two questions intentionally incorrect.
Right.
So think of it that way. Here's Hugh with question two.
Okay, Mary, here we go. Tom Brady did not want to disrupt his new team or wide receiver Chris Godwin. So for the first time in his career, Tom Brady will not be wearing number 12. True or false?
True.
Good answer. Good.
Which is right.
Mary, you got it wrong, which is what you needed to do. I like it.
Godwin will give up his number 12, and he'll wear number 14 next season for the Bucks.
There you go. Okay.
All right. Okay.
So you got to get this one wrong.
Okay.
Bo Bichette was one of two Blue Jays to hit 300 or better last season. True or false?
False.
Yes!
Woo-hoo! Oh, my God! Woo!
It never paid so much to be wrong, Mary. Congratulations. It is, in fact, true. Bo Bichette, and until he was traded, Eric Sogard were the Blue Jays' two 300 hitters or 300 or better hitters last season. And by the way, tonight at 7 o'clock, it's the Bo Bichette walk-off game against the Yankees from September of last year. Congratulations, Mary. You win $100 in Untuckit gift cards. And we should let you know, if we don't have a winner on a given morning, the $100 rolls over. So we will give away $100 again tomorrow morning, Friday morning at this very time. Be listening for your cue to call to be the contestant in All or Nothing. Ross Tucker of the Ross Tucker Football Podcast. The NFL is expanding its playoffs, adding one team from each conference, so two teams overall. And given now that there are an odd number of teams in both the NFC and AFC making the playoffs, it nixes the first round bye for the second seed. Only the top seeds in each conference will get a first round bye in the NFL playoffs. We'll get into that so much more. Shai Davidi will be along. We'll talk a little baseball, and he's been watching a lot of the old school games being aired on Sportsnet, and he's going on about, hey, I'm really enjoying watching these games that aren't interrupted by replays and requests for reviews by managers, coaches, players, and umpires. We'll get into that with Shai. Wendell Clark is coming up later on in the show. And what have you been binging during the COVID pandemic as we all socially isolate? We'll get into that next. We're waiting for the chorus. Still waiting. Getting close. Rest in peace, Adam Schlesinger, the frontman of Fountains of Wayne, who died at age 52 yesterday of COVID-19.
52? Holy cow.
Stacy's mom. Just an epic song and an epic video.
Yes, it was. One of the best.
Damn, man. I mean, there's really nothing else to say, but I could listen to this song. I mean, classic hits, Key 590, Ryan Mon, keep spinning them tunes, and we'll just comment in between.
It's a banger.
I bet it is. Shai Davidi in just a few minutes. Ross Tucker later this hour. Wendell Clark will join us in an hour from now, and we'll see what he's up to, presumably from his couch in between episodes of Tiger King or whatever it is that Wendell is binging these days. And that leads us to our Rank It segment. Hugh Burl is with us. What have we been up to? What have we been binging? I assume we've all been watching TV. I don't think we should do this segment without first clarifying. With all these hours in the day, we're hanging out at home. We're not doing anything. We're watching TV. Is that what we're doing?
Yeah, a lot of TV. A lot of YouTube
Our
videos,
streaming services.
A lot of Netflix.
What do you YouTube?
A lot of Crave.
What do you YouTube? Hugh,
really interested.
What does YouTube?
Okay,
what's YouTube?
Here's what Hugh tubes. A lot of Formula One. I know you're gonna shock. A lot of Formula One in car camera videos.
Okay.
Yeah. It gets worse, Mon. It gets better. I watch guys who simulate racing. I watch a
Thank
lot of.
Thank God
sim
you.
So I watch guys playing games.
Thank God you said
the game.
Thank God
watching.
You said racing after the word simulate, because that could have gone anywhere at that point. And we are now into the 7 o'clock hour of this program. It's now family time, Hugh.
I'm such a loser.
Any of the Blue Nui stuff
I'm trying to
needs
convince,
to be in the 6 a.m. hour.
I'm trying to convince 5 Feet of Fury to allow me to buy a racing rig complete with a wheel and the screen and the whole game so I can compete.
You lost your leverage, Hugh. You could have held the Birkenstocks with socks photo against her and said, this, and this, or else I tweet it.
She doesn't mind that, though.
You just went out and tweeted
it. She thinks it's a fashion statement.
You just went out and tweeted it. You lost your leverage.
Bottom line is I'm a loser and I'm just watching basically just garbage.
Okay, well, we'll see what Mon does with the drops for me. Because on YouTube, I...
Oh, yeah.
trying to picture what might be going on over top of this music bed. On YouTube, I'm doing deep dives into a few old school wrestling podcasts. Yeah.
I didn't realize you were such a huge wrestler.
No idea.
Yeah.
Not so much.
Yeah, he didn't. He's never talked about it. He got excited when I was like, you know, it's not real.
He took it to task.
He took it personal.
It is not fake.
I said it was not real.
Predetermined athletic theater.
Are you still watching without the fans?
No, I'm honestly not.
It's tough to watch.
I haven't watched a lot in the last couple of years, but I go back to the Attitude Era of the late 1990s, Stone Cold Steve Austin,
yes.
The Rock, and then on the WCW side when Hulk Hogan became a bad guy, that was epic. So there are a lot of podcasts out there. This guy named Conrad Thompson from Alabama, I'll get his name out eventually, Conrad Thompson from Alabama is doing a bunch of different podcasts. One is with Jim Ross, one is with Eric Bischoff, and one is with Bruce Pritchard, who was Brother Love on TV way back in the day, but he's a behind-the-scenes guy. Like one of the creative guys who comes up with the storylines and stuff. So they talk about all the old pay-per-views, what it was like back at that time behind the scenes. And that's the stuff that I'll actually pull it up on YouTube and I'll listen to clips of that as I'm puttering around the condo.
I'm very cool, Hugh, by the way. Well, you grind me for watching guys play a video game, yet you're watching.
I'm listening.
You're listening. And you said YouTube. You're listening and watching to things that have already had a predetermined outcome, and they've already happened.
Yeah, but it's
so. Which of us is the bigger loser? That's what I'm asking.
Intrigue behind the scenes. Behind the scenes is what I like.
I have got. Well, I like my documentaries.
Oh, listen to Poindexter over there.
I haven't gotten to Tiger King yet. I don't watch any of the new shows. What are the new shows out? I don't even know what they are. I don't watch them.
You've already decided. Is that new?
No chance.
For shows, I used to watch Suits,
yep.
Entourage.
Yep. That's going back like a decade.
That's about it. Now, I'll rewatch the old ones.
And you're a Seinfeld guy.
I like my Seinfeld. Yeah. I am a Seinfeld guy, so I've got all of them kind of saved. Is it the PVR? No, whatever it's called. Ignite demand.
Yeah.
So I've done the Tiger King thing because I felt like it was show prep.
Yep.
I mean, it's just so zany and
damn right it is.
Pathetically crazy. I'm loving Outlander. I've talked about that before, I think, but that's a grind. Like the first season is 16 episodes, and then there's like 10 to 15 episodes in the subsequent seasons, and they're up to like seven seasons now. So that I'm moving through a lot slower. And then the other thing that I've done, and you talk about going back in time, I've really felt like through this period, I need a laugh, mm-hmm. and nothing makes me laugh more than Seinfeld.
It is great.
And so with Rogers Ignite, you get Crave. And Seinfeld is on Crave.
Perfect.
So it's on demand now. I don't have to sit there and wait for the 7 o'clock syndicated episodes to come up on one of the channels or the 11 p.m. I just pick the Seinfeld episode I want to see, and I do it.
Every day.
And watch it.
Every day I click on a Seinfeld episode, and I click save all. So it'll save all Seinfelds for the day.
So each day you've got like 45 episodes.
Yeah, they're all saved. I have every single episode, and they have the Crave.
Yes.
Whatever you want to call that.
So it's
yeah, it's yeah, I need a laugh as well. I will say I've been getting into some of the mob movies like the Casino, Godfathers.
Godfather 3 actually is one of the best movies.
Goodfellas.
In the history of filmmaking, right, Mon? Godfather 3?
Yeah. Isn't it Godfather 2 is my favorite?
Mon doesn't seem to like Godfather 3.
No, it's nobody, a
Hugh.
Yeah.
Hugh.
Oh, I was like, I didn't know. You guys got me again.
Yeah. Hugh was just trying to draw Mon out there. Godfather 3, Godfather 3, Godfather 3.
Casino, Goodfellas, Godfather 2.
You see that?
Right there. But your holy trinity.
You'll be surprised that some people will go to you and say, man, Godfather 1 and 3 were just the best out of the three of them. And you kind of like...
1 and 3?
I know.
Walk away from those people.
I've heard one and three, so when you said the third, I wasn't too surprised.
Is that a dig across the table? What is Shai Davidi? Oh. What has Shai Davidi been binging over the course of the last few weeks? Well, Shai is with us now, baseball insider, Blue Jays insider for Sportsnet. Although I would imagine, Shai, as a married father of two boys, you haven't had a lot of time to just plunk your ass on the couch and catch up on the latest from Netflix.
Sadly, that is true. I haven't all these grand visions of shows that I would be binging. I've not, but us and the kids have been watching a lot of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, catching up on that. Okay. And it's just right on the border of appropriateness for the age where they're at. So we've definitely been having some laughs with that at night.
So how did you come up with, I think the kids are at the age where they can handle this. Was that a conversation?
It wasn't a conversation. Essentially, we started it, and then a few references in the show where we were cringing a little bit, and then the rest of it, we're like, well, we're stuck together anyway, so we'll figure stuff out as we go along.
I mean, one of the things you have been tweeting about here, Shai, of late is just some general commentary, some thoughts, some opinions that have come to you as you've watched some of the throwback ball games that Sportsnet has been airing. And there have been games as recent as last season, like Vladdy Jr.'s debut, and games that take us as far back as the early 90s when the Blue Jays were in the playoffs and on their way to winning a couple of World Series. What goes through your mind as you sit there and take these games in? And I am leading you down a path, because I do read your tweets. There's the pre-review world and the post-review world, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, there certainly is. And I think when you watch the classic games, obviously that's pretty, it's stark, the difference. And, you know, when watching some of the games from the 92 ALCS, you know, there are a few close plays on the base paths at home plate. And you just see the guys, just the umpire makes the call, and, you know, they may not like it, and then they just head back to the dugout. And there's just there's no arguing, there's no complaining. And on top of that, there's just that there isn't that automatic, you know, standing, pointing to the dugout, saying, hey, you know, like, replay that, I was safe, the way there is now. And most of the time, guys are wrong now anyways. And that's really interesting to me. It's just it certainly impacts the pacing of the game, and it's kind of refreshing. But then you think about, to me at least, the potential for mistakes and the impact that they could have. And then that was really reinforced during World Series Game 2, where in the fourth inning, Roberto Alomar gets called out at home. He's definitely safe. Ed Sprague doesn't win that game with a home run in the ninth inning. You know, that missed run could have loomed large for the Blue Jays, because they would have been down 2-0 in the World Series on a botched call, and then all of a sudden the entire history has changed, and that can live with the franchise for a long time. The way Carey Fraser's missed high stick on Wayne Gretzky, Game 6 of the Kings Leafs, still haunts Toronto Maple Leafs fans. So, you know, as much as it sort of looks good, and you appreciate not having to deal with the replay nonsense, ultimately I landed on it's better to just get it right.
Do you think even with all the review now and how it can benefit the game, that you might lose some of the fans, especially, I mean, when you're going to a game, I just know this from going to watch hockey games, that sometimes with all these offside reviews, it is slowing the pace down. You're, you know, shifting momentum at times, and a lot of fans just don't want to sit there while they review every single out or play at the plate. It's one of those things where, you know, it really, I find it changes the game at times.
Yeah, 100%. And to me, the issue is when it gets distorted for things like, you know, a guy's foot coming off 3 centimeters, the base pad on the base when he slides in on a pop-up slide, or in hockey where, you know, a guy's skate blade might be 4 centimeters offside and it hasn't really you know, significantly alter the play. It's not a really big, it's not a really big mistake. And sometimes it's on a really relatively inconsequential play. That to me is where, you know, the drawbacks are. But if that's the trade-off of not having, you know, a game of import decided by a missed call and then all the controversy that comes with it, and then potentially an illegitimate, you know, maybe an illegitimate championship even, you know, I think ultimately that's where you end up having it be worth it. Now, I mean, can you tweak the rule so that, you know, teams aren't twisting it for any little infraction that really wasn't what you were intending replay to correct? That to me is a question that now is a really good time for leagues to wrestle with.
Shai Davidi is with us. He is Sportsnet's Blue Jays and MLB insider. This is Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. All right, back to some old topics that are potentially new again here, just to check some boxes and make sure that everything's going to be all right whenever baseball returns to us. And Shai, I'm of the opinion this is a lot further down the road than any of us would like. I'm just not confident we're going to get much of a season, if any, here. But that's me, and I'm not overly informed on the matter. I'm just seeing the trajectory of this virus. Vladimir Guerrero Jr., everybody has dispersed. Everybody has gone home. To the best of their abilities, I would imagine the Blue Jays are going to try to monitor the behaviors and the habits of all of their players. Is there any angst in the front office about the potential for Vladdy to not stick to the program, whatever that program is, well, everyone is away?
I mean, I would say that there's lots of angst, but not specific to that. You know, I think it's basically everything that is related to any player right now is filled with angst, because you just don't know. I mean, one, players don't have any sort of ability to work out the way they normally would, right? Especially if they're closely adhering to the social distancing requirements. So that's a fundamental issue. Two, you know, obviously you're concerned that your player may come into contact with the virus, get infected, and perhaps have some adverse effects from it. So that's definitely something to have angst over too. And three, you know, when you're in this sort of situation, in this stasis, I mean, mentally for an athlete, it's got to be incredibly difficult, because, you know, athletes are so regimented, and Mike, you can definitely speak to this, but like, you've got calendar points and that's telling you what you need to be doing at any given point in time. And you can tailor all your exercises towards what the calendar dictates. And now it's just basically this indefinite stasis. And as an athlete, you really have nothing to look forward to. I mean, you want to be in shape and you want to be ready, but you can't work out the way you normally would. You can't have any of the associations that you normally would, and you don't have a date to work towards. So I think all those things make, you know, the status of every athlete incredibly difficult right now, especially one who put in so much work. You know, you can use technology and you can use some of those some of the techniques now to stay on top of guys. But, you know, everybody's working in a fashion that is so far from normal that it's going to be very difficult to maintain what they've accomplished.
Yeah, I think, I mean, each sport's a little bit different. You know, it's for guys in the NHL trying, you know, you're going to need ice to stay in shape. I don't care how many laps you run or how many shots you take in your backyard into a net and you know, for baseball, I think it would, you know, I think it would almost be tougher than kind of hockey. I mean, unless guys have a batting cage in their backyard or guys to, you know, to stay in shape with. And, you know, I just find baseball to be even tougher than something like, than hockey. I don't understand how guys in baseball can kind of stay sharp.
Right. I mean, like, and the Jays have kind of told their pitchers not necessarily to fully let it go, but they've told them to ramp down and not to try to throw and maintain what they've got. You know, I spoke to Jordan Romano last week reliever for the Blue Jays. And, you know, he's got no one to play catch with right now because he's really observing the social distancing recommendations. And so, you know, he's doing his weighted ball routine against a brick wall. But, you know, he can't exactly dial it up to 98, 99, which is where he was at during spring training, you know, throwing against a brick wall in your driveway. So, you know, I think that's sort of the challenges that a lot of guys are facing. I think for hitters, this is generally going to be easier. I mean, you're going to have an adjustment period where they're going to need to find their timing at the plate. Cause I mean, that's another thing you can't simulate. But you know, pitchers, the longer that they're off and the further away we get from spring training, the more time they're going to need to build up. And, you know, if you try to rush through that, that leaves them vulnerable to injury more than any other player.
Shai Davidi is with us. This is Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. I'm asking specifically about the Blue Jays and as it relates to some of the edicts from the city of Toronto, Shai, understanding, of course, that Major League Baseball is not going to come back until this virus is beyond us. And so much of that is outside of our control because, of course, 29 of the 30 MLB teams are located south of the border. And as I've described on this program earlier this week, the U.S., in my view, is a tinderbox right now, and everybody has brought accelerant and or lit matches to the party. As it pertains to the City of Toronto edicts, the fact that there can be no public gatherings through to the end of June at publicly owned facilities or parks, that, of course, does not extend to Rogers Centre, Scotiabank Arena, or BMO Field. Is your sense that the Blue Jays will comply, even though they don't have to, comply with whatever the City of Toronto, the province of Ontario, maybe even in the federal government of Canada, whatever those edicts and those regulations and those laws are, the Blue Jays will simply abide by those?
Yeah, I mean, to me, you can't really imagine this having the ban on in the city, and also the provincial one, which is in some ways the more key than the City of Toronto one, limiting gatherings to five. You know, you can't just ignore that, pretend that that doesn't exist and say, oh, hey, we're going to open up the dome. Let's get 30,000 people in here if we can. You know, that's just not realistic. And I think what the real indication of that is sort of like how right now, based on the numbers and the models, how the city is seeing the infection rate and the amount of cases that we're going to see trending. And so they don't see an ease in the trends till June 30th, at least. And it could certainly be longer than that. But I think right now that's sort of the best case for them. And if that's the best case from health officials, you know, obviously baseball is going to have to follow that. They can't simply, you know, act unilaterally here and say, hey, well, we don't care what you guys have to say. We're getting going. And so, you know, if that's the trajectory in Toronto, Scott, you're absolutely right. You know, the U.S. isn't anywhere near as good a shape as we are. And if we can't play here through at least the end of June, it's hard to imagine that being possible in the United States either.
Thanks for this, bud. Always good to catch up. We'll call on you again very soon.
Anytime, fellas. Stay healthy. Talk soon.
You bet. Shai Davidi, Sportsnet's Blue Jays and MLB insider. Justin Bourne coming up at 8:30. We're looking forward to chatting to Wendell Clark at the top of the 8 o'clock hour. And up next, Ross Tucker on the NFL expanding its playoffs. It's going to cost one team in each conference a bye week as it adds one team from each conference to the playoff picture. So we were talking about, Ziggy, the shows that we've been binging in our isolation or our distancing. Sam from Toronto, the best Seinfeld ever, because we got into Seinfeld, the best Seinfeld ever, Fusilli Jerry.
Fusilli Jerry's great, but there's better than that. The Hamptons.
I saw The Hamptons the other night.
By far, if I can rewatch something.
I was in the pool! I was in the pool, but it was just
it shrinks.
And Elaine, it shrinks. I don't know how you guys walk around with those things. It's just so many good components to that episode. Yes, the Hamptons is up there. I actually watched yesterday or the day before when George converts to Latvian Orthodoxy to date.
Very good. Yes.
And then she at
the
end.
For the hats.
For the... What do you like about our religion? I like the hats. Very pious. Very pious. Anyway, we could go on and on about Seinfeld, but we won't right now. Ross Tucker, our good friend, you hear him each and every week here on Leadoff during the NFL season, and we bring him on in the offseason whenever news is being made, is with us now, and that's because the NFL has expanded its playoffs in time for the 2020 season, presuming, of course, we have playoffs. And so I think the way to intro this is to say, here's what this season's playoffs, or the just completed season's playoffs, would have looked like in the expanded format. So there's an extra wild card team per conference. And because now each conference has an odd number of playoff teams, the second seed will no longer get a first round bye. So the 49ers and Ravens this year would have gotten the byes in the NFC and the AFC, but the two seeds, the Packers and the Chiefs, would have had to play in the first round. So in the NFC, the Los Angeles Rams would have made the playoffs and visited Green Bay. The Pittsburgh Steelers would have gotten in as that third wildcard team and would have visited Kansas City in the first round of the playoffs. That's how it would have played out under the new rules in 2019. Ross is here to discuss. Ross, great to catch up. I hope you're hanging in through all of this weirdness. Do you like what the NFL has done here, adding a playoff team in each conference and taking a bye away from each team in a conference?
Yeah, so good morning, guys. Always great to talk with you. Hope everybody in Toronto is hanging in there as well. You know, kind of mixed emotions. Overall, I would say I'm in favor of it, but I don't love every aspect of it. So, look, I'm a football guy, right? So two more games to watch, let's do it. I love the idea of watching two more games. As a guy that a couple times on teams that were 8-8, 9-7, just barely missed the playoffs, Buffalo 04 comes to mind, Redskins 01. I like the idea of another team getting that opportunity, getting that chance. I think it's good for those players. I think it's good for the coaches that probably saved their job because they made the playoffs. You know, from a player standpoint, it's a lot of revenue, so I love that. I mean, you're asking really four teams to play one more game, and you're injecting a lot of money into the system for the players. So for all those reasons, I like it. Now, I don't know that we would have been enthralled by a Duck Hodges-Patrick Mahomes matchup in the wild card weekend. I guess the thing that I'm a little bit nervous about is I feel like we're putting too much of an emphasis on the number one seed. It already is really important. It already is the goal for everyone. You want home field advantage, obviously. It's huge. But now it just doesn't feel like the second seed has that much importance. Like, sure, it doesn't feel like the second seed is that much different than the four seed. And I just don't like that. I feel like the way it has been, you really are trying to get the number one seed. But then you're also really trying to get the number two seed, so you get that bye, and then three and four, whatever, and five and six, whatever. Now, I just don't like that, you know, a 13-3 Green Bay team is the number two seed, and they're really not any different than a 9-7 Philadelphia team. That's a huge difference, four games, and yet they're basically in the same situation. I know that if they ended up meeting up later, that Green Bay would have gotten the home game, whatever, but it just doesn't seem like the number two seed's getting enough love, getting enough benefit for the great season that they've had.
With Ross Tucker, and this feels like an obvious question, Ross, and the revenue benefit to the players will be realized, but I would imagine that having that bye is just so huge. If you're seriously injured, it probably doesn't matter, but in terms of healing bumps and bruises, what do those extra 7 days, 8 days mean to a guy at that point in the season after he's already been through 16 hardcore regular season games?
It's like a relief, you know? It's like you want to get that bye so badly because you know how nice it'll be for that week to really be able to relax, recharge your batteries, and get ready to win two playoff games to go to the Super Bowl. You know, I think it's physical, but it's also mental. You know, it's like, okay, I can recharge a little bit, you know, heal up, take this week to get ready, because after that, you know, three games, we are world champions. So it's a huge goal. Now, the one thing that's weird about it, I think they've changed this, is that teams on the bye didn't get paid. So, you know, the teams that actually are playing a game that week actually get money. But at that point, the playoff money isn't that significant compared to what these guys are making now. And really, at that point, I think the guys would rather have the bye for the chance to win the Super Bowl than to play that week for the money. And I think they might have. I have to check on this. I think they might have done it so that now everybody gets paid for that week, even the team that's on a bye. But, yes, I think both physically, mentally, I'll even throw in there emotionally, getting that bye is a significant thing. I know people sit here and think, how hard is it to get motivated for a game every week? And it's not, but there's kind of like different levels of motivation, right? And, you know, when you go back to the preseason, that's every week for 20 weeks. You know, you get that 1 week off, it kind of builds to a fevered pitch when you actually do come back from that bye.
I want to get your opinion on some of the free agent moves by the teams, some of the best contracts, worst contracts you've seen done here in the free agency period.
Yeah. Well, I like what the Philadelphia Eagles have done. I wasn't thrilled with them giving up third and fifth round picks for Darius Slay. But if you look, you know, I think Slay was the best corner available. And it's really like a two-year deal with him making about $13 million a year for those 2 years. Now, the next 2 years after that bump up, but he'll have to be playing really well for them to keep him for those 2 years. So they got him for 2 years for, you know, $4 million less than like what Byron Jones is getting from the Dolphins. I actually also thought Javon Hargrave, you know, he's a guy that in Pittsburgh was a 3-4 nose tackle. So he wasn't really like just trying to get in there in the backfield and wreak havoc and make plays like he'll be doing in Philadelphia. And so I compare and contrast it to what the Colts did, right? They trade the number one first-round pick, 13th overall, to the Niners, and then they paid DeForest Buckner $21 million a year, whereas the Eagles got Javon Hargrave for $13 million a year. That's not even 62 cents on the dollar of what Buckner's getting. And they didn't have to give up any draft pick. And I think Hargrave's pretty good. So I like what the Eagles did. I liked what the Raiders did, actually. Some of the guys that they brought in didn't really care for what the Detroit Lions or Chicago Bears did. And don't even get me started on the Houston Texans.
Yeah, DeAndre Hopkins. This is one of the top receivers.
I literally wrote this week. I don't know if you guys are subscribers to The Athletic or not.
Yes.
If you guys are looking, and I wrote this on Twitter, at Ross Tucker NFL, if you guys are looking for topics, because I know it's a strange time, read my article in The Athletic, because I made the case that the DeAndre Hopkins trade is the worst trade in NFL history. And that's not hyperbole. That's not like, oh, here comes Ross with the hot take. Because I know what you're thinking, right? Herschel Walker or Ricky Williams, whatever. Think about it. Like, even the Herschel Walker trade, the Vikings got a good player. Like, Herschel Walker was a good player. It, you know, if you think about the DeAndre Hopkins trade, David Johnson for $10.2 million guaranteed when he can't play anymore and over $2 million guaranteed next year, that essentially cancels out the second round pick in my mind that the Texans got. So they really gave up DeAndre Hopkins, who's arguably the best receiver in the league with 3 years up on his contract at like $9 million a year less than Julio Jones for nothing. And then I think so that can be, I don't need to be your producer. I know Ryan and Mike do a great job, but Monday's show Was it the worst trade in NFL history? Then Tuesday, is Bill O'Brien the worst GM in NFL history? Guys, he's been on the job for 9 months. He traded a third-round pick for Duke Johnson, like a third-down running back. He traded two first-round picks and a second-round pick for Laremy Tunsil and still hasn't signed him to a new contract. The guy, which they've got no leverage. Tunsil's going to be by far the highest-paid offensive lineman ever. He traded Clowney to the Seahawks for a third-round pick and then paid $7 million of Clowney's $15 million. And then we just talked about the DeAndre Hopkins trade. This is 9 months, guys. So anyway, that's your Monday and Tuesday next week if nothing else happened.
And here's
Monday is the worst GM of all time. Tuesday was the DeAndre Hopkins trade, the worst trade in the history of sports.
And here's the Wednesday topic, Ross, and weigh in on it now. The Belichick coaching tree. How many guys have escaped, I don't want to say escaped, but left New England and gone on and really owned it? I mean, Josh McDaniels effectively went crawling back there after the awful experience he had in Denver, which was essentially his doing. You know, Bill O'Brien. I'm trying to think of guys who've branched out and really accomplished away from Bill Belichick.
Well, you know, in fairness, I think Bill O'Brien, I mean, the Texans have made the playoffs like four out of the last 5 years.
Fair enough.
I actually think Bill O'Brien's a decent coach. I just think he's the worst general manager in NFL history. I think he's having a tough time having both those roles. I kind of like what Brian Flores did last year in Miami. His first year, they thought they would be winless, and he got those guys to play. I don't know how that really helped them. Now they got to try to trade up to get a quarterback. It didn't really help them what they did last year, but he showed he could coach at least. You know, Mangini had some good times with the Jets before the owner made him take Favre. So I don't know. I mean, Vrabel, I don't know if you count Vrabel. He didn't really coach with Belichick, but he played for him. If you count Vrabel for Belichick, I think that helps. But you know what I think happens is those guys, they really only know the Belichick way. And I think Matt Patricia is going through this in Detroit. And so they kind of try to act like Belichick. And unless you've actually accomplished stuff, guys just don't buy it. So first of all, they don't really think it's authentic. They don't really think it's you. They think it's you pretending to be Belichick. And secondly, you know, I was in New England, guys, in 05 and 06. It's not like a fun environment. And it's tough to get guys to buy in unless you're winning Super Bowls, right? Like, if you're having success and these guys are getting rings and parades and stuff, okay, let's do it. If you stink and you're still trying to be that way, I just think, you know, like in Detroit, Darius Slay didn't really buy in. I mean, it's tough to get the buy-in from guys. They're like, well, who are you? What have you done? You were in New England. Great. You had the best quarterback ever and the best coach ever. So why do I think you did anything there?
Pivot one more time before we let you go, Ross. Is Philip Rivers, and I know we're talking apples and oranges here in terms of quarterbacking style, is Philip Rivers, given where he is at, given the issues he had last year with the interceptions with the LA Chargers, is he a clear and obvious upgrade on Jacoby Brissett?
I think he will be with the Colts because of his familiarity with Reich and Sirianni and the offensive coordinator, and because of how good that offensive line is playing indoors. I think he will be, yes. I think he processes the game at this point better than Brissett because of his experience. I think Reich will know how to use him and know what to do and what not to do with him. And I think, you know, he still threw for 4,600 yards or something, guys. You know, the year before they were 12-4 and he was excellent. You know, he had a bunch of interceptions last year. But he's like, he's got that Fitzpatrick in him where he throws two picks and they're down by two touchdowns. He doesn't care about throwing two or three more. Like, he's just going to keep chucking it to try to win the game. So I think it makes his stats look worse than they really are.
Thanks for this, Ross. Appreciate it. Look forward to catching up again soon. Stay safe, dude.
See ya.
You bet. Ross Tucker of the Ross Tucker Football Podcast. Get him on Twitter. Never shy of an opinion. At Ross Tucker NFL. And he's with us each and every Monday during the NFL season. Let's talk that Roger Goodell, the $44 million a year commissioner of the NFL, could conduct the NFL draft from his home. because he makes all the announcements, right? He announces all the picks.
When you're making 44 mil, I think you can put a draft on in your house.
I'll tell you what, there better not be any burps in that streaming system. That better come off clear. He can afford the very best. He better not be on some 56K internet.
It's not confirmed.
No, there's just speculation out there that he could conduct the draft later this month from the confines of his home in Bronxville.
I feel like they're going to be the most aggressive out of all the sports.
Well, it always comes up NFL, man.
NFL.
Like it, you know, and I don't like playing down the significance of the virus, but of course it came up in January, February as the NFL season was fading away and there's 7 months in between games. Like if there's one league, and I'm not even convinced it's going to be like this, but if there's one league that won't actually have its in-season interrupted by COVID-19, it would be the National Football League. Like, we're not going to hear anything about delaying games or delaying the start of the season for a while still. We're into July now with significant events on the sports calendar getting knocked off. The Open Championship, as we call it, the British Open in golf, is going to be banged here. Wimbledon has been canceled.
The U.S. Open, they haven't done anything with it yet.
Well,
in the PGA, I think it's the last sport event in June that hasn't
yet been.
Yeah,
but there you are overseas.
U.S. Open
getting so the overseas getting out in front of it. The French Open, they want to play at the end of September. That's typically a May tournament at Roland Garros.
They want to move it,
but Wimbledon
done. Not even a postponement.
Yeah, well, because when are you going to play it?
Yeah.
Right, because they're going to try and sneak the French Open in. That's going to be weird if it actually happens too, because it's coming out of hard court season, and then you're back onto clay with none of those Madrid or European-based clay court tournaments to tee up. Going to be strange if it happens, and I still say if it happens. Justin Bourne at 8:30, former Leafs captain. We can't wait for this conversation. We had him in studio a number of months ago. Great chat for a full hour. But we're looking forward to a 15-20-minute chat with former Leafs captain Wendell Clark. He kicks off the 8 o'clock hour of leadoff. Well, here goes nothing. We've got Essential Ziggy somewhere else on a headset. Oh, my God.
I am here. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Too loud?
Take the microphone out of your mouth, Essential Ziggy.
I just want to make sure you guys can hear me all right.
There we go. Now, where the hell are you? Have you gotten lost in the building? It can get windy and maze-like.
There's actually a love seat in the offices that's quite comfortable. It looks like it's leather.
Get out of my chair!
And I'm hanging out with Hugh Burrell in the back, so this is kind
of
nice.
All right. Well, maybe Hugh can throw some of that feedback into your headset that he had yesterday. That'll send you sideways into next week. All right, so your headset works. This is where we're at now. We're now testing equipment live on a radio show. That's our life now, Ziggy.
That's where we're at.
Coming back, or are you just going to stay wherever it is you are on that leather love seat?
This is quite comfortable, and I might do the rest of the show from over here if you don't mind.
By the way, Warren in Newmarket texted into 590-590 about the NFL playoff picture and how it's going to change. Scotty, a reminder, if the Raiders had made the playoffs, you would have had to have gotten the Mark Davis haircut. Yes, Warren. But remember, that promise does not live year over year. That was one and done. One and done, Ziggy.
Well, we're going to have another Raider bet this year, and I cannot wait.
We'll have a Raider bet, but you can damn well be sure it's not going to be me.
The haircut's off the table?
Promising a haircut like Mark Davis's. No. No, I do not want to look like Mark Davis or James Gerritsen from Tiger King. If you don't know who that is.
I don't know what's worse.
I'll show you a picture. Wendell Clark leads off the 8 o'clock hour of leadoff. Play on words. Next. Right, we've been enjoying Sportsnet's rerunning of some old hockey games. I brought up the other day that Kirk McLean save on Robert Reichel in the 94 playoffs overtime, which was then followed up, I think, a period later in double overtime by Pavel Bure deking out Mike Vernon, Canucks advance. The Kirk McLean save, timing of it, quality of it, Theo Fleury's pass across the ice to Reichel, unbelievable. Still stands with me 26 years later.
I've watched it a couple times now. They've had it. It's been running more than once.
Yeah.
He actually made, I think, just as big a stop as he did with the two-pad stack. It looked like it was like low glove, same first OT. I think it was a bigger save. I'm trying to think who it was on.
Really?
But he made a couple big saves. That was a big, I mean, you had the
like goal. That was a wow moment, Ziggy. The
goal
pad
judge.
Stack.
The goal judge put the light on. Like, he thought it was in.
Sure. And that puck was pretty much on the line. But I remember watching that game live. I was old enough to be up that late and thinking to myself, I'm never going to forget that save. I mean, whether the Canucks go on and win the Stanley Cup or not. But, I mean, so many memories are coming to us. The Doug Gilmour behind the net wraparound goal in game one against St. Louis in 1993. The epic clincher, Gilmour to Rouse with the kind of slap pass to Nikolai Borishevsky, past Tim Cheveldayin the Leafs' advance, beating Detroit in the first round of 93. Here's a guy who was there for all of those amazing Leafs memories. Good enough to take some time this morning. Former captain Wendell Clark. Wendell, what's up?
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Guess what we're up to. We're alone. We're hanging out by ourselves. How are you getting through this time? I assume it's kind of the same as everybody.
We're the same as everybody. We're isolated, and that's about it. Just our own time. I'm actually up where I'd normally be. I spend 6 months north and 6 months in the city, so I started early in the north, so that's where I am. More space than being isolated.
All right. Well, you're an influencer here, Wendell. So before Ziggy jumps in, is there a Netflix recommendation you've got? What is Wendell Clark watching to kill time?
No, not TV. I'm not 24/7 on TV like my rest of the family. No, I'm outside most of the time. I'm getting ready. You have to prepare to get ready. So I've been sitting on the dock making sure I'm really ready and know how to do it come July.
So yeah, we've been reliving, pardon me, the 93 playoffs and the run the team made. I guess we'll start off with Detroit. When you guys were in that series, did you kind of, after the first two games, was it kind of like, all right, we have nothing to lose at this point and play like that? I can remember the 2004 Red Sox were down, 3-0 the Yankees. And it was almost like, you want to know what? We're down a couple. We're probably not going to come back. This is all going to be over.
No, I don't think we ever thought that. It's funny, that whole series, the three games we lost badly. And I think the four games we won were all one-goal games, or almost overtimes in all of them. So it was a weird series that way. Yeah, but the first two games, yeah, they beat us badly in there. And I remember starting the series. Before the series started, you go through all the coaches' player meetings, and Bernsey said, if there's one thing that happens, you are not to have a fight in the series, and you are not fighting Probert. So after the first two games and we lost badly and I didn't have any fights or change the game or anything, everybody was all over me. If you looked at the media, that didn't try to change the game or didn't do this, and it was basically all part of a Bernsey's game plan not to get involved. And then we come back and win the next two close ones at home, and then go into Detroit and win, then come back home in game six and lose badly again, and went into game seven and snuck that one out with Borchesky's goal.
Well, Wendell, those days were the very early days of this very radio station in an all-sports format. And we all remember Storm and Norman Rumack. And he was on late night. He was a late-night vampire. And this city and the fans, you're right, they were all over you. And Storm and Norman, I recall this to this day, was your great defender on this radio station at that time, and it led to some great debate. I would imagine you're holed up trying to stay focused on the next game, on the series at hand. But clearly, based on your comments, you were also aware of some of what was being said. How engaged, if at all, were you in that at the time? Or were you having friends call? Wouldn't have been any texts. Were you having people inform you of what was being said and what was being written?
Oh, we know full well. Everybody follows everything. And, you know, if the Leafs are in the playoffs, what the media scrums are like, they're no different now than they were then. So there have been a media scrum after every game, after every practice, after everything going on, asking and stating questions. So that was all part of it. That's all part of playing the game in Toronto. We had the coach had a game plan. You know, come playoff time, nobody's tipping their hand to what the game plan is. You don't talk about injuries. You don't talk about what goes on. And as a player and one of the leaders on the team, you just suck it up. And here's the game plan, and let's play it out. And come the end of game seven, the tides have all turned, and then there was all good comments again.
So the edict not to fight Probert or not to fight anybody in the series, was that Detroit specific? Because obviously later on, and apologies for gaps in my memory if anything went on with the Blues, but I recall you very clearly, we all do, jumping in on Marty McSorley after he had laid a hit, an open ice hit on Doug Gilmore in the, I guess it would have still been the Campbell Conference as opposed to the Western Conference, and the Campbell Conference final. So was that a Detroit-specific edict?
Yeah, because when it happened, one of the comments was, well, I never got told I couldn't fight Marty. So, and basically that was, you know, by the time we got, you know, St. Louis was a pretty physical, so all the series that we played were pretty physical, and they all went to the seven games and stuff. So, but that game one there, I guess, against LA, you know, Dougie was, you know, the best player in the league that year and the best player in the playoffs. And Marty come across and got Dougie at the stage of the game when we were going to win anyway. I don't know if it was 5-2 or what the score was at that stage. And Marty was probably just setting a tone for his team and everything else that was going on. We're not out of this type thing. That's why he would have stepped up and did that. And so then that really raised the temperature of that whole series. It made it for a fun series. I was the one that made the wrong mistake. I said he went and hit Dougie. I should have skated over the bench and punched Wayne.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was the guy that ended it for us. So I'd have been better off going over the bench with Wayne.
Yeah, not let him play that game seven. Man, was that a performance.
Something that sticks out for me, I mean, in 93, something you don't see anything, you don't see it anymore is, what is it, 21 games in 40 days, did you guys?
42.
42?
Yeah.
So, like, that. How did that, what was your schedule like? Were you guys even practicing at that point?
We were, like, today, I laugh, I just watching my son play coming up through the American League. I said, the kids today, or the players today, they don't practice at all. We were pretty much practicing every day. And then in the first round, second round, pretty much every day, and morning skates.
Wow.
And then going into game seven in Detroit, it was an optional morning skate, and I didn't do it. Then Burns, you said, why weren't you out there? And I said, you said you'd just show up for the game. Didn't matter if I came to practice. And so right up to game seven of that series, it was an optional. A lot of the games in St. Louis were probably mandatory morning skates, and then come the LA one, it was a little more optional because now you're into the third round and we're going east-west. Such a lot of travel by the time that series came.
Yeah, I just remember because it really stood out looking at Doug Gilmore through that playoff run, Wendell. Did you guys just marvel at it? He was playing at such a high level that obviously he was able to keep himself in condition to keep going. And I don't want to, I guess it's not fair to single out Doug. You guys were all going through the grind. But Dougie was not a big guy to begin with, and he would look at times just emaciated. Like there was not another pound on that body that he could possibly lose.
Yeah, no, he was getting pastier and pastier as the playoffs. And you look back now and you look back at the pictures and really, but Dougie, like come that series, Like I never played, like everybody remembers that I was, you know, it was Dougie and I playing together. Well, we really didn't play together ever until the playoffs. Cause you had the Peter Zezel, Ozzie and Bergie line as a checking line. And you had, in that year, you had Dave Anderchuk and Borsesky and Dougie as your first line. And then it might've been Eastwood, myself and Rob Pearson or Foligno or John Cullenwood's a centerman. Or so I kind of was with, would form the third line. And come playoff time, what happened was Dougie ended up double shifting. He'd play first and third. So Dougie would play with Borchewski and Anderchuk in the first line, and then he'd come down and he'd roll with myself and Robbie Pearson or myself and Foligno or myself and Glenn Anderson. And so Dougie played two lines for all the playoffs. So he was playing 24 minutes with the playoffs. So he was going hard, and I remember in the first series, and that was probably the first time I seen the IV drips to help rehydrate, where Dougie was doing that just to stay hydrated. And I think it was Dave Ellett and I were sitting beside him in the training room and asking him how his rehydration was going, because he was on the IV drip to try to get healthy. And Dave and I had the slice of pizza and one of those light drinks that we always had in the dressing room after. He says, our rehydration tastes a lot better than yours.
Yeah. Carbing up. I like that, with a little pizza. I can only imagine the look on a trainer's or a medical person's face if a guy was crushing a slice of pizza in this day and age, in the middle of the regular season, let alone in the middle of a big time playoff series. Amazing how things have changed.
Yeah, no, it's really how the, you know, and we practice more, guys played and today they practice less. It's all about conserving the energy and saving it for the game. We're pretty much really old school. If you had a bad game, your next day's practice is an hour and a half. And that was, and you didn't even take into account, well, you know, the good team, and there's, you know, you have a good team in the league and a bad team in the league. Both teams are going to try the same way. They both try hard. But one team's better than the other. We're on the losing team. The coach always was guilted into making sure, well, we might have lost, but we're not going to get outworked. So he made sure he worked you in practice. And really, you'd be worse the next day because he left it all on the ice in practice. And so the thinking is way better now than it was back then.
With Wendell Clark, this is going to be a weird question perhaps for you. Do you ever find yourself going down your own rabbit hole on YouTube? If an old school game that you were involved in is on TV, and there have been far more of them, Wendell, now than there have been at any point, just because sports networks are looking for content without actual current sports taking place, do you sit down and watch? Like, have you watched Game 7 against Detroit? Have you watched Game 7 against St. Louis or even L.A. at any point over the last 25 plus years?
No, I haven't. No, I haven't watched any of it.
Okay.
You may watch highlights when things come across, you glimpses and pieces of stuff, but I don't ever sit down and watch the game. It's funny, when we used to do the old games with Bonesy with Leaf TV, and you wouldn't even remember. So we'd be doing playoff games that back then. We'd be doing playoff games that we did in the 80s. And they'd say, okay, we're going to do this game against Detroit in 86. And we wouldn't even, I can't remember anything about the game. So we'd get the tape and we'd watch the parts of the game. And it's amazing. But as soon as you started watching the game, the whole game came back to you in your mind. You remembered the whole game again. But if you were just to ask me about it without seeing parts of the game on video, I would have never remembered the game.
Do your kids, or have your kids ever come to you, or friends of your kids come to you and said, hey, I saw this fight of yours on YouTube the other night, tell me about it? Or is it just kind of understood, look, I get it, it's all out there, but you watch what you want and keep it yourself?
Yeah, no, the kids when they were younger didn't see as much, but once they all got older, they all and then they started asking more questions and stuff, because they watch all the stuff on YouTube. So my son would have been, they've been all part of watching all that stuff. And then as they got older in their teenage years, they started asking questions about that, because the game they were watching in the NHL growing up, there was none of that stuff going on. And then this was all kind of going on. Like, what was a 5-game suspension now, back then might have been a 2-minute penalty. And so they're going, that was, they were thinking, you know, there was just different rules and the game wasn't as fast and things like that. So it's just how the game has evolved.
Well, that's the biggest thing that jumps out at me is, I think in that Calgary-Vancouver game that was just on, it was, I mean, each shift you could have called 3 or 4 penalties. Some guys had, you know, breakaways and they were getting hauled down. I don't mean just a little hook or tug. It was like feet right from underneath them. And you just realized how much tougher the games were back then compared to today.
Yeah, you had to skate through everything then. There was, like you say, I had a lot of man-on-man. If you played wing, as long as I had my defenseman up the ice, or if you're a third guy back, you were skiing beside the guy. There wasn't any back pressure. And so you just picked up your guy, and you're with him, and you basically pitchforked it right through his gut. You're riding with him all the way back. And it might have been it was harder to play through. Defensively, actually, probably wasn't as good, where now you have your stick on the ice and passing lanes. It's actually harder now. It was better then to score goals than it is today, because now everybody's making sure your feet are in the right position, your stick's in the right position. It's actually harder to make plays today, especially with the speed of the game. And back then, everybody just picked their guy up and physically took him out of the play, where today that's not allowed. So it's, in a way, it's made the game better in that all sizes of players can play the game today. It's whether can you skate and can you think, the two biggest things. And you got to be brave enough to go to the areas in every era. That's the same. But if you can skate and think, you can play the game. It doesn't matter size. Where back then, a big strong guy could take a little guy out of the play, and there's nothing he could do about it. There because it wasn't a penalty, especially in the playoffs, it wasn't a penalty.
Looking back on it, Wendell, because you were still rolling through the mid to late 90s in your playing career. And you've touched on some things. I think you're talking early 90s here, but was one of the worst things in hindsight to happen to the NHL the fact that the New Jersey Devils won the Cup in 95 playing the style that they did, and the fact that they rolled the Red Wings unexpectedly in the Cup final, swept them that year, the left wing lock, the neutral zone trap? Was that a demarcation point, or was the game always kind of played that way and it just, for lack of a better word, got talked about more, celebrated more, that style of play?
Well, the game in the 90s, the game started getting covered more, it's in 92, 93 when the sports, was 24/7 on the radio and TV and stuff. So, but in the 80s, you go in the 70s, Montreal Canadiens played the trap since the 70s. They were the first team to do all that stuff. And nobody thought anything of it. They were just better than everybody else, but they were the first team that was really coached. Here's how we forecheck as a team. Here's the neutral zone as a team, and here's the defensive, and that's the way you have to play. Where all the other teams in the league were not that stringent on how you were to play the game, and so there was always lots of mistakes, and Montreal was doing it forever. And then, but they did the, you know, there's different versions of the trap. If when I played in Quebec, the trap was you force a guy at the red line and he either had to dump it for an icing or he caught the puck up. Where if you were an offensive team, you did the trap inside the blue line, the offensive end, because you wanted to keep the puck in the end zone. And so it wasn't called the trap then, but it really was. You just did it in a different zone. And so the game was really started that way, probably in the 70s with Montreal. And then in the 90s, because New Jersey did it so well with a great set of defense, and then Brodeur, who could handle the puck better than their defenseman could, like he could, other than Niedermeyer and a couple guys, he was a better passer than the rest of their defensemen. So they just held the line and held everybody up. Because I remember that, I think that last playoff series, I think we only had like 5, 6 shots, 7 shots on net that whole series when we lost in 99-2000 to Jersey.
With Wendell Clark on leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Certainly won't ask your opinion on when you think hockey's coming back. None of us know the answer to that question. But given your experience having played, Wendell, and the fact that you're around the Maple Leafs a lot as one of the prime alumnus of the team, the fact that you are following your son in his trajectory in professional hockey, so you would be quite familiar with how players are training today, do you have an opinion? Do you have a sense of what it will take for players to appropriately be ready whenever it is the league gets back up and running? Are we talking days? Do you think we're talking weeks of like a mini training camp type thing? What do you think a player would need to get ready to play and compete in the playoffs should the National Hockey League be able to get back in some form this season?
I don't think it takes any time at all. The players are in way better shape on a continuous basis, but even the shape of the players doesn't really matter. Everybody makes this a big deal about where everybody's at and can you play, and it really doesn't matter because every team and every player is at the same stage. If they say we're playing in 2 days, every team's under the same format. So the hockey might not be very good because nobody's played, but everybody's equal. Nobody's not equal. So you can start at whatever stage you want to start at. That it really doesn't matter. I don't think the injuries would change. I don't think anything would change. It you know, because the players are kept, you know, they keep themselves in much better shape on a year-round basis. And everybody's at an equal stage. It'd be different if one team was training together the whole time that this was going on and the other 29 teams weren't doing anything. That's different. But every player is under the same situation. So I think whenever we can get back to normal, it's just status and go as quick as possible. I think more now than ever because it is a partnership. It's 50-50. The players and the league want this to go just as the business end and the revenue end goes.
The sun is up. The weather today and through the rest of the week and into the weekend looks great, Wendell. So get out there on the dock, enjoy it. And we'll be calling to bug you again because I think we're weeks and months away from the return of normal sports. We love going down memory lane with you. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, guys. Take care.
Thanks, Wendell.
Former Leafs captain, the great Wendell Clark. These are uncertain times for all of us, but many Canadians, including children, face the fear of not knowing how, where, or even if they will get their next meal. And with the economic impact of COVID-19 deepening, food banks across Canada are concerned about not having enough food to meet demand. In fact, we're told many food banks only have enough food for the next 2 weeks. We have the opportunity to step up and donate. And the best way to do that is by donating money. Please go to foodbankscanada.ca, foodbankscanada.ca. Please give whatever you can. Every dollar helps. If you have a little extra money lying around, foodbankscanada.ca. And if you can't, that's okay too. We're just asking that if you have some extra cash kicking around at this difficult time, foodbankscanada.ca would love to have it. Justin Bourne on, well, stuff. I mean, that's where we're at now, right? Ziggy, are you leaving the booth? Is Essential Ziggy?
I was getting ready to go back on the couch.
No love seat this time. You got to go find another spot.
I'm telling you, the seat, the couch that I found, and you know what's next to it? There's a little bit of a putting green. So I might bring my putter in.
There you go.
Work on my stroke. Whoa.
Perfect.
While we're on.
We will put on the headsets at some point, and we will have the essential putting contest. We're going to have to do it. There's going to have to be something on the line. We'll figure it out. Justin Bourne next. Testing 1, 2, 3. Essential Ziggy, are you there?
I am here.
You are
there.
And everywhere. Essential Ziggy, everywhere. You back on the love seat or what?
I'm on the love seat, yeah. I haven't taken any putts yet though, but the putting green is staring me down right next to me.
I think that shows a stunning lack of creativity that you went back to the very same spot when there are so many different options you could check out. You should do a segment from the toilet stall at some point. Why not?
All right. I'll check out different
Essential rooms. Ziggy Essential Ziggy in the crapper. You know? Go for a walk. Well, it's a lovely day. Essential Ziggy outside. Tell us what you see. Probably nothing.
You think I can talk in from anywhere? Or do I have to be in proximity?
No.
How's this app working?
Dude, you could fly to Kazakhstan. Well, you couldn't get a flight out of the country right now, but ordinarily. You could become Borat.
So you're telling me I could be in Costa Rica right now doing this?
I'm not going to give you any ideas, pal. Because I can tell you, if you're going to Costa Rica, so is the rest of the station, the entire crew. On air, off air, we're all going, and we're going to live there forever and ever and ever. All right, we got to get to our buddy, Justin Bourne, one of the co-hosts of Hockey Central at noon, 11 to 1 right now on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and he will appear for a full hour on Good Show starting at 10 o'clock this morning. Hello, sir.
Good morning, gentlemen. How's everyone today?
We're good. Is that isolation low-key coming from you? We didn't get the upward inflection on the good morning.
I wanted the happy. Good. Okay, now we can start.
Justin Bourne is long dead. He doesn't even exist anymore. I can't find him in my soul. Hey, hold on. Before you guys get started, I'm just listening to the lead into this here, the update. Did we have O.J. Simpson on the station? Where was that quote from?
Oh, God.
That was from, he got approached out after a golf round, and he was talking about Tiger King, and he went on about how the show's ridiculous and that he's only 6 episodes in, which apparently it's only 7, and that it's terrible, but he did watch the 6 of the 7 so far, and that... it was gold. I think the best part about that interview was that he had latex gloves on. I don't know why that stood out to me, but he did the interview with the latex gloves on coming off the golf course.
And as you know, Justin, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit.
I almost said the poor guy. I don't mean that at all. But the guy, he can never wear gloves again without someone being like, making a glove joke. It's just unbelievable to me that, like, in our society, that we're like, this guy murdered a couple people, but we're all in on it, right, guys? It's the strangest thing.
Yeah, anyway. And he's just parading around, calling on golf courses to stay open. He's happy to play by himself, and because he posted this on Twitter like a week or two ago, he's like, and I don't want to, if they close the golf courses down, I'm going to go crazy. And I'm thinking to myself, how could you even joke? I don't want O.J. Simpson going crazy. That's already happened.
My Lord.
Whether a jury believes it or not.
Just awkward.
So you've got an article coming out later today on sportsnet.ca. You're a busy man today. You'll be on Good Show 10 to 11, and you'll be doing your Hockey Central at noon duties. You've got an article coming out on sportsnet.ca. Ziggy and you will discuss sticks and flexes in just a second, but also staying in shape during these weird times. How do you go about doing that? What can we expect to read in your piece about that, Justin?
Well, it's just the concept of how different all of our living situations are right now and how that pertains to being a professional athlete. You know, something that all hockey players have learned is that hockey shape, like game shape, there's kind of no way to replicate it. I don't know if it's exactly the same in other sports, but in hockey, you can do wind sprints, all the baggers you want. You can do whatever sort of cardio you want. There's nothing like game shape, just the quick twitch muscles and the stops and starts, and it's really hard to stay in game shape. So, you know, what guys are doing right now is going to be very important if they say, hey, the NHL is coming back and it's playoffs. Like, the fitness level of the guys is going to have a huge outcome or input on what the outcomes of these games are. And I actually think it kind of works in Toronto or against Toronto a little bit, because a lot of the guys here live in small apartment complexes. And that's just, you know, compared to maybe someone like myself, the apartments, you wouldn't call them small, but they live downtown Toronto. These are not huge places. So, you know, there's no gyms. They don't have access. You know, we talked to Jason Spezza on Hockey Central yesterday, and he talked about, you know, he's got a house. He's got 4 daughters. He's got a gym. He's got all this ability to properly stay in shape, and I'm not sure that that's the same across the board. So I just think it's going to be interesting when the guys come back, who found a way to stay in shape versus who didn't. I know Justin Hall bought a Peloton, and I talked to Brendan Leipzig in Washington. He bought a road bike. Guys are trying to find anything they can to keep their fitness as good as they can.
With Justin Bourne, Wendell Clark was with us earlier on this hour, and I mean, he's got a son playing in the American Hockey League. Justin, he doesn't think it's that big a deal. Get him back out there. Yeah, well, he said everybody's going to be singing from the same songbook. So, because I think you'd need a week or two of training camp at least, and maybe I'm being generous. Like, it might even be longer. But Wendell didn't think so.
Well, a week would be fine, I think. I don't think anything longer.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. I think if you get a week in, and that's gonna be all the guys need. But still, even with that week, I just think that the levels of the guys, certainly they'd be an acceptable level to play competitive hockey. I just think that there are going to be guys who have found a way. I know I'm Spezza, and I have four daughters and a wife at home. And I mean this with all due respect to Spezza's family. I would spend so much time working out. I know with my own wife and kid, like every day, I'm like, well, I'm going on a world record setting length run, even though I hate running, just because it's nice to be out and moving and by yourself for a bit. So I think guys are just going to have very varied levels of fitness, even though, yes, they would all be able to play after a week or so.
Yeah, I just don't see how many times. I mean, you can run yourself into the ground. You know, I've done different training weeks in the summertime where we're cycling for 100K and, you know, two-a-days in the gym. But until you actually get in a game or get into practice, nothing will. Even if you're skating yourself, there is something about the atmosphere and the intensity level of a practice with other players that separates anything. So I do like the fact, and I mean, Justin, you know what it's like. Once you take 2 days off, it's like you forgot how to skate some weeks when your body's just not used to going on the ice.
Yeah. I think of the mirror game all the time. Like if you're doing a mirror drill, so you're facing another hockey player and they do this in hockey camps and, you know, someone does sort of the Gretzky shuffle one way and you have to mirror them and they back up and you back up and you're trying to mirror them. If you're the person dictating the actions, which is what you're doing in the summertime, you're leading all your own actions, it's hard, but it's not that hard. You can do the stop, starts, crossovers, whatever. If you're the person doing the mirroring, the quick reacting, and trying to do what they're doing, it's super hard. And that's what game action is to me. It's the you're constantly reacting. You're not dictating the action, which is what you're doing when you're training in the summer.
Now, part of your article that's coming out, I know you mentioned that we were going to talk about good sticks. You want to lead this one?
Yeah. Well, I just, you know, this is someone I know with the way that you played the game and all the little details were important to someone like yourself and in what made you successful. And so this is kind of what I focused on today was when I was at the Toronto Marlies a few years ago, we went into Lake Erie, and now the Colorado head coach, Jared Bednar, coached Lake Erie. So we couldn't get a sniff. We had William Nylander. We had Kasperi Kapanen, Zach Hyman, Josh Levo. Like, at the AHL level, we were stacked. We ended up with 20 shots on the game. They beat us 2-1. And honestly, I had never seen such a display of good sticks like this. So we talked to Jared Bednar at Hockey Central on Monday, and he talked about the things that are important to his team and how he coaches and just how integral having a good stick is. And by that, you just mean having a stick as close to the opposing player's stick and puck as possible, not swinging or lunging or throwing your weight off, just placing that blade in a difficult situation for the puck carrier. I thought it was interesting to hear him talk about how important that is to Colorado. And if you look at the Avalanche, this season, they're sixth in the league in goals against. They don't give up many goals. And part of that is just because of how important those little details are to them. So, yeah, in my article today, I focused a little bit on what it means to have a good stick, how important it is, and one of the reasons that I believe Colorado, that having details like that combined with their offensive firepower kind of makes them one of the front runners for the Stanley Cup, or would have. You know, we'll see if we have a Stanley Cup playoff or not.
Yeah, and I like that. When you talk about good sticks and coaches that really emphasize that in practice, it's really the details, and the coaches that will actually take that and work on something like that, it will make a huge difference in a game. Oh, yeah. And guys that I remember playing against would be like a Lidstrom in Detroit, where he wasn't always too concerned. Yeah, it was the best stick ever, because even though you weren't a threat in certain spots on the ice, he'd always have his stick out at you, where whatever you think you had, you actually did it, and you had less space, and it was almost suffocating on the ice playing against guys like that. And then later on in my career, getting a penalty kill and being part of special teams, you really notice the best guys in the league are so good, and especially those forwards playing on the top of the box, just quick, trying to read, and just times where you don't think you're doing anything, you're actually doing a lot. So that's interesting how, you know, you've reached out to coaches and how they said that's kind of something they work on and really emphasize.
You know, it was really another thing that Bednar was into is he said, and I know this is, these things sound obvious until you really beat them home and do them better than other teams, but he talked about communication. He said that when the Boston Bruins come to town, he said, watch them in practice. He says he's not surprised they are where they are in the standings because there is a constant noise and a constant chatter. And he says when the game gets hard, that communication and guys always talking to each other is what sets a team like Boston apart from the rest of the league. And that's, you know, Stewie on our show, because once in a while he gets a hard time because he's always saying details, details, details. But these are the little things that separate good teams from bad. So it's just one of the things, trying to focus on actual hockey here in the absence on our way back, that I thought there was some interesting points that Bednar made.
You're a busy man today, Justin. Thanks for doing this. And we'll catch up with you again next week.
All right, guys. Thanks for having me.
I bet.
Thanks, Justin.
Justin Bourne of Hockey Central at noon. He'll be on Good Show, the 10 to 11 hour with Ben Ennis and J.D. Bunkus, and look for that article on good sticks and staying in shape in this weird time where you can't necessarily work out with your trainer, you can't get to the gyms or the rinks that you would usually use. Check out Justin's piece coming up later today on sportsnet.ca. We put a wrap on this baby. Does Essential Ziggy come back into the room, or is he fallen in love with the love seat, wherever the hell it is that he is? We'll get into it next. We need a camera on Ziggy for the bumper music.
Yeah, what was he doing just now?
That's my dance. That's my move.
That's what they used to get on the speaker with the sticky shoes and stages in Kingston.
That was my stages move. Yeah. Sorry.
How'd that work for you? Was it successful?
We actually have a lot of people writing in about stages. You know that, right? Lot of people text
I don't
line,
see them. They
Twitter, yeah, they talk about how we're endorsing stages. How are they part of the show? But I mean, it's just, if you've been to stages, you get
if you've been to Kingston and you've experienced the nightlife, you have inevitably wandered in either on purpose or by accident into stages. That's all it is.
Was that the move that you were throwing down at stages?
That was the speaker, sticky shoes. Backslide.
It must have been a handstand or two on the speaker, too.
No, never.
You would have been able to keep your balance because your hands would have stuck to the top of the speaker.
I haven't seen moves that stiff since I had sciatica. I'm just saying.
Have you had sciatica?
Yes.
Oh, my God. That's just got to be.
It's the worst.
Yeah, it's the worst. The pain. How'd you get through it? You got any sciatica advice for sciatica sufferers?
Saw an athletic therapist and followed his instructions quite closely.
Okay.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to get through it?
About 6 months.
There you go.
Yep.
All right. Well, you've had sciatica. Things you learn.
Yeah.
We're allowed to go home now. You learn one thing each day. You're allowed to go home.
I'm just upset I got to sit in this chair. I actually did like the love seat.
What was going on?
Can we bring the love seat in here?
Not a whole lot. I had to walk by and shake him just to make sure he was still awake.
Was he sprawled out, starfished on this love seat at this point?
He wasn't starfished. He was more slouched than anything.
You going to bring your pillow in tomorrow and lie down?
I might. I might bring a little blanket and just put my feet up. Put the blanket on, pillow back.
We shouldn't have told him that he doesn't have to be within proximity for the app on his phone that he was using to work.
Would it be bad if somebody went to Costa Rica to do this?
You're in Costa Rica. You're in Palm Springs. You're somewhere where you want to be in like a week. We never see you again. You just do the show from different points of the globe. I think we've just opened up a dangerous, dangerous can of worms.
I'm on a group chat quickly with the Pittsburgh Penguins 09 team, and one of the players got on a last-minute flight to Mexico because he didn't want to be stuck in the U.S. at home, so he took the family down, and now he's in Mexico. So that's...
In Mexico. Now.
We'll talk about who it is
we'll
tomorrow
need a
or
name.
Monday.
We'll need a name tomorrow. We are back at 6 o'clock. Elliot Friedman will be among our guests on Friday mornings. Friday morning, as if there's more than one at a time. Good show is coming up next. Have a great Thursday.
Sorry, I'm still talking.